Okay, tonight I want to pick up what we left off in the book of Isaiah. We left off in chapter 41. And let's just get right into it because we are running a little late. But it says in verse 1 of chapter 41 of the book of Isaiah, it says, "Coastlands, listen to me in silence, and let the peoples gain new strength. Let them come forward, then let them speak. Let us come together for judgment. Who has aroused one from the east, whom he calls in righteousness to his feet? He delivers up nations before him. He subdues kings. He makes them like dust with his sword, as the wind-driven chaff with his bow. He pursues them, passing on in safety by a way he had not been traversing with his feet. Who has performed and accomplished it, calling forth the generations from the beginning? I, the Lord, and the first, and with the last, I am he." Now, you know what, before we go any further, I just want to break this down, because there's no doubt in my mind, if you just read this for what it's saying, I think it could leave us basically with just a lot of question marks as to what exactly he's talking about. But let's just analyze it, break it down, because it really speaks to us today. It's not just something that was written 750 years ago for the people back then. Because this is God speaking, and what he's really talking about here, he's talking about the second coming of Christ. Now, I'm going to read these four verses again. And I've already told you that this has to deal with the second coming of Christ. And now see if you can see it. Because he says, "Coastlands, listen to me," listen to God, "in silence. Coastlands, listen to me in silence, and let the peoples gain new strength. Let them come forward, then let them speak. Let us come together for judgment." Now, he's talking about coastlands. He's really talking about all the different nations. And he says, "Listen to me in silence." Now, here's the thing. We read in Habakkuk, we read in Micah, where basically God says, "Let all the earth be silent before the Lord." And just look around us today and look at all the confusion and look at all the different, just everybody's speaking over one another and everybody's at conflict with one another. But when God stands up, it's almost as though he's saying, "Hey man, shut up." Because that's what it's saying. Coastlands, listen to me in silence. In other words, nobody's going to be speaking over God. Nobody. You see, he's the final authority. He's the last word. And when he says, "Coastlands, listen to me in silence, and let the peoples gain new strength, and let them come forward, then let them speak. Let us come together for judgment." Now, what is he talking about there? When he says, "Let the people gain new strength, and let them come forward, then let them speak, and let us come together for judgment." Predominantly, he's talking about his own people. He's talking about the Jews. But he's talking about a time in history when there's going to be this all-out war down there in Armageddon. And all the nations of the earth are going to be brought down there. And that's where God is going to judge these nations. He's going to judge them severely down there. And he's going to use Israel as basically his chastening rod to bring down the whole world. Because you read all throughout the prophets, especially like the prophet Zechariah, talks about in the end days that Israel will become a burdensome stone to the whole world. And we read in Revelations that God is going to bring all the armies of the world down there to Jerusalem, down there to Israel, and he's going to judge them, and he's going to judge them severely. And what he's going to do when he's down there, he's going to come back, and he's going to come back with great power and great glory, and he's going to deal with these armies. Because like it says in Revelations chapter 19, it says this, "And I saw the heavens open, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat upon it is called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and wages war. His eyes are a flame of fire, and on his head are many diadems, and he has a name written on him which no one knows except himself. He is clothed with a robe dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies which are in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, are following him on white horses. And from his mouth comes a sharp sword, so that with it he may strike down the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron. And he treads the winepress of the fierce wrath of God the Almighty. And on his robe and on his thigh he has a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords." Now, it says that he's coming back on a white horse with all the armies of heaven with him. And his eyes are a flame of fire. What does that suggest to you?
Judgment.
His eyes are what, sir?
A flame of fire.
He's coming back in judgment.
Yes, but when his eyes are a flame of fire, that suggests he's angry.
Right.
He's filled with righteous indignation. And you know, there's an old saying that goes, "Beware the fury of a patient man." And God has put up with so much for so long. And once the envelope was pushed so far, then he's just going to stand up in judgment. and he's going to judge the world, and he's going to judge these armies down there in Armageddon. I remember when I was in the Marine Corps and I was in Vietnam, the sun was going down. I was sitting by this stream, and I was just sitting with a buddy of mine, and we were just talking, you know, just smoking cigarettes and just chewing the fat. And we were talking about the war, and he said, he mentioned Armageddon, and I said, Armageddon, what's that? And he said, well, it's the last battle of the world. And I said, what? That sounds like science fiction to me. You know, I didn't know anything about the Bible, but I was, you know, talking.
You weren't into the Bible.
No, I wasn't a Christian at the time. But ever since, you know, I got back from Vietnam and gave my life to Christ and started reading the Bible, and then I read about this incident where he's coming down there, and he's coming down there with great wrath. And when he comes down, this is what John writes in Revelation chapter 14. He says this, another angel came out of the temple, which is in heaven, and he also had a sharp sickle. And then another angel, the one who had power over fire, came out from the altar, and he called with a loud voice to him who had the sharp sickle, saying, put in your sharp sickle and gather the clusters up from the vine of the earth, because her grapes are ripe. So the angel swung his sickle into the earth and gathered the clusters from the vine of the earth and threw them into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden outside the city, and blood came out from the winepress up to the horse's bridle for a distance of 200 miles. Now, I want everybody to understand something. What's the wine press?
Well, judgment of God.
I just said it. Armageddon is the wine press.
Oh, okay.
Armageddon, when all the armies are down there, Jesus Christ is coming back in great power and great glory, and every eye is going to see him. And it appears that the sun is going to go out, and there's going to be, appears to be, 3 days of darkness. And at the very end, when all these armies are fighting down there in Israel, when it all seems lost, Jesus Christ is going to come back. The sky is going to roll back like a scroll. Heavens are going to be opened up. Jesus Christ is coming back on a white horse with all the armies of heaven behind him. And he's going to speak the word and expunge every last drop of blood out of the veins of all these men down there in Armageddon who literally actually turn their guns on him and start firing at him, because we're told that in Revelation that they wage war against the Lamb. And he speaks the word, expunges every last drop of blood out of their veins. And that's the wine press. And their blood flows for how many miles?
200.
200 miles, the entire length of Israel. And how high?
Of a horse's bridle.
The height of a horse's bridle. So, you know, you figure, if you've got, now this is speculative on my part, but if you've got, I just read it here, when you've got an army of 200 million men that are down there from the east, you probably will have an army a similar size or maybe larger from the west. And just do the math. Let's just say you've got a half a billion people down there fighting it out. Well, how many quarts of blood in the average human being?
Seven.
It's about six, okay? It's about six quarts of blood just coursing through the veins of an average human being. Now, multiply that out, 500 million times six quarts of blood, and you're going to have a river of blood. Now, I know that sounds very gruesome, but people don't put this together when they're reading about what Isaiah has predicted, you know, 750 years before Christ, because when he says this in that verse 1 of chapter 41 of Isaiah, coastlands, listen to me in silence, and let the peoples gain new strength. Let them come forward, then let them speak, and let us come together for judgment. And he's going to use the Jews to judge the world, to bring the whole house down. He says, who has aroused one from the east, whom he calls in righteousness to his feet. He delivers up nations before him and subdues kings, and he makes them like the dust with his sword, as the wind-driven chaff with his bow. Now, if you just read that and you're not taking it in the context of everything else that's been predicted, it's pretty hard to figure out what he's talking about. But break that down. Verse 2, chapter 41 of Isaiah. Who has aroused one from the east, whom he calls in righteousness to his feet? Who's he talking about?
Yeshua HaMashiach.
He's talking about Jesus Christ when he comes back, but he says he's coming from the east. But you know what? What's very interesting? If you go back to the 65th chapter of the book of Isaiah, it says this. When Christ comes back, it says, who is this who comes from Edom? Anybody know where Edom is?
Edom
is south of Judah.
Okay.
In other words, it's right down in here. It's known as Mount Seir area. And over here is Mount Sinai. But keep this in mind. When Jesus Christ is returning, the great power, great glory, and every eye is going to see him, he's coming from the east. But what it says in Isaiah chapter 63. It says, who is this who comes from Edom with garments of glowing colors from Bozrah? This one who is majestic in his apparel, marching in the greatness of his strength. It is I who speak in righteousness, mighty to save. Why is your apparel red and your garments like the one who treads out the winepress? And you remember, I just read in Revelation chapter 19 that Jesus Christ's clothes are dipped in blood.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not his blood. It's not his blood. Yes, it's when he speaks the word, he is splattered with their blood. And keep this in mind. It's very poetic and it's justice because these men have rejected the blood of Jesus Christ, and now their own blood is going to stand as a witness against them. And it says here, when it says, it is I who speak in righteousness, mighty to save. Why is your apparel red and your garments like the one who treads out the winepress? Now, what's the winepress?
Armageddon.
Good. Somebody was listening. I have trotted the winepress alone, and from the peoples there was no man with me. I trod them in my anger, and I trampled them on my wrath, and their lifeblood is sprinkled on my garments, and I stained all my remnant. Did you hear what it's saying there? As a matter of fact, I'm just going to just go back to Revelation 19, where it says this. He is clothed with a robe dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And you wonder, well, whose blood is it? It's their blood, because it says here, I trod them in my anger, and I trampled them in my wrath, and their lifeblood is sprinkled on my garments, and I stained all my remnant. For the day of vengeance was in my heart, and in the year of redemption has come. I looked, and there was no one to help, and I was astonished that there was no one to uphold, so my own arm brought salvation to me, and my wrath upheld me. I trod down the peoples in my anger, and I made them drunk in my wrath, and I poured out their life's blood on the earth. Now that was Isaiah 63, talking about a second coming of Christ. It goes hand in glove with Revelation 19, when Jesus Christ comes back with great power and great glory. And you know, when Jesus Christ comes back, it says in Isaiah chapter 24, it says, behold, the Lord lays the earth waste, devastates it, distorts its surface, and scatters its inhabitants. And it goes on to say, the earth will be completely laid waste and completely despoiled, for the Lord has spoken his word. The earth mourns and withers. The world fades and withers. The exalted of the people of the earth fade away, and the earth is also polluted by its inhabitants, for they transgressed the laws and violated statutes and broke the everlasting covenant. Therefore, a curse devours the earth, and those who live in it are held guilty. Therefore, the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men are left. Now, well, how would they be burned?
Sun.
The sun's gone out. Nuclear destruction. And then it goes on. It goes on to say, they raise their voices, they shout for joy, they cry out from the east concerning the majesty of the Lord. When Jesus Christ is coming back, he's coming from the east. But it says this, therefore glorify the Lord in the east, the name of the Lord, the God of Israel, in the coastlands of the sea. From the ends of the earth we hear songs, glory to the righteous one. But I say, woe to me, for alas for me, the treacherous deal treacherously, and the treacherous deal very treacherously. Terror and pit and snare confront you, O inhabitants of the earth. Then it will be that the one who flees the report of disaster will fall into a pit, and he who climbs out of the pit will be caught in a snare. For the windows above are open, and the foundations of the earth shaken. The earth is broken asunder. The earth is split through. The earth is shaken violently. The earth reels to and fro like a drunkard, and it totters like a shack. For its transgression is heavy upon it, and it will fall and never rise again. I mean, this is what the prophets have been foretelling for centuries, that what's going to happen at the end of the world. And when Jesus Christ comes back in his great power and great glory, there's going to be only two classes of people. When Isaiah is saying here, woe to me, because the treacherous deal treacherously and more treacherously, what did he mean by that? Well, he says this, from the ends of the earth we hear songs, glory to the righteous one. When people see Jesus Christ coming back in great power and great glory, there's only going to be two classes of people. The ones that say, glory to the righteous one, praise God, hallelujah, here he comes. These are the saved, these are the people who gave their life to Jesus Christ during this terrible 7 years tribulation period. And when they see him coming, they're going to have tears of joy streaming down their face. But then the other class of people, it says, but I say, woe to me, alas for me, the treacherous deal treacherously, and the treacherous deal very treacherously. In other words, hey man, there's going to be no fence sitters here. There's going to be no apathy, no indifference, no lukewarm. People are going to be either at war with God, or they're going to be committed to him. All right, when Jesus Christ comes back in great power and great glory, and when he comes back, there's these two classes of people. The ones that they say, oh, praise God, here he comes. And then the other class of people, what are they going to be doing?
Good. The rocks to follow.
Because it says in Isaiah chapter 2, it says this, enter the rock and hide in the dust from the terror of the Lord and from the splendor of his majesty. The proud look of man will be abased and the loftiness of man will be humbled and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. For the Lord of hosts will have a day of reckoning against everyone who is proud and lofty and against everyone who is lifted up that he may be abased. And then it goes on to say, the pride of man will be humbled and the loftiness of men will be abased and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day, but the idols will be completely vanished. Now listen to this. But men will go into the caves of the rocks and into the holes of the ground before the terror of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty when he arises to make the earth tremble. And that day men will cast away to the moles and to the bats their idols of silver and their idols of gold which they made for themselves to worship in order to go into the caverns of the rocks and the clefts of the cliffs before the terror of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty. When he arises to make the earth tremble. That's what it says in Isaiah chapter 2 in regards to what men are going to be doing. But also it goes hand in glove. It's almost verbatim where John predicted in the book of Revelation in chapter 7 when he says this, and I looked and when he broke the sixth seal and there was a great earthquake and the sun became as black as sackcloth made of hair and the whole moon became like blood and the stars of the sky fell to the earth as a fig tree cast its unripe figs when shaken by the great wind. Now I'm just going to throw this out here, all right? He's saying this, when the sixth seal was broken, he says there's a great earthquake. And he said the sun becomes as black as sackcloth. And he says it looks like the stars are falling from the heavens. Now put this all together. I believe, I'm firmly convinced of it. As a matter of fact, I am so convinced that I bet my life on it. I'm not kidding you. All right. Now I could be wrong. I'm not trying to just be dogmatic. Okay. There may be some other explanation down the line, but I really believe, well, what the prophets have foretold is that our sun is going to explode. Because we read in Revelation 16 where it says the angel pours out his vial upon the sun and it scorches men with intense heat. And in Isaiah predicted that there's coming a day when our sun is going to become seven times brighter and our moon is going to become seven times brighter. So you get a situation where our sun actually explodes, but when it explodes, it appears to cave in on itself and our sun is going to go out. It's going to go out like a light bulb. It's going to become as black as sackcloth. So when our sun goes out, it's going to have an effect upon our earth. How?
Gravitational
pull. Because our earth is spinning at 1,000 miles an hour on its axis and is hurling through space at 67,000 miles an hour. And the crust of our earth is floating at the most. It's only about 15 miles deep. And so the whole earth, once the sun goes out, I just read in Isaiah that our earth is going to stagger like a drunken man. It's going to sway to and fro like a hammock. And then the crust of the earth is just going to be going back and forth. Everything's coming down. I don't care whether it's the Eiffel Tower, whether it's the Sears Tower, whether it's the Golden Gate Bridge, whether it's the pyramids of Egypt. Throw it out there. Everything's coming down. Every freeway, every building. We saw the Twin Towers come down. Every building on earth has come down like that. It really is. It's going to be massive. It really is. And then when he says in the Revelation chapter 6 about the seal, he says when the stars fall from the heavens. Now, obviously, it's not going to be literal stars because what's the closest star that we have to us?
Alpha Centauri.
It's Alpha Centauri, and it's probably about 4.5 light years away. So it's when he says the stars are falling from heaven, in Revelation, the stars of the sky fell to the earth as a fig tree casts its unripe figs shaken by a great wind. What was John seeing?
Debris from the
Good.
War.
Exactly. What he's seeing is the debris of an exploded sun entering our atmosphere along with all the garbage we've got rotating around up there, all the satellites and space stations and everything else. When they start entering into our atmosphere, it's going to look like falling stars.
No,
it really is.
Won't work, huh?
What's
our iPhones won't work.
Your iPhone won't work, I guarantee you. You know? All right? And then he says that the sky was split apart like a scroll when it is rolled up. Meaning this, at that time, the sky's going to roll back and heaven's going to be opened up and men are going to see Jesus Christ coming. And then it says here, the sky was split apart like a scroll when it was rolled up and every mountain and every island were moved out of its places. And how does that happen? I just told you. Earthquake. Because of the worldwide earthquake. And then what it says, when this is happening and they see Jesus Christ coming, this is what John says in Revelation chapter 6. The kings of the earth and the great men and the commanders and the rich and the strong and every slave and free man hid themselves in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains. And they said to the mountains and the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the presence of him who sits upon the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of their wrath is come. And who is able to stand? Now that's exactly what I read in Isaiah chapter 2. That they're going to go into the caverns and the caves and the rocks and the cliffs and the bomb shelters everywhere trying to hide from Christ. That's what I'm saying when there's only going to be two classes of people. So you go all the way back to where we started here in Isaiah chapter 41, and you put this all together, especially like that verse 2, who has aroused one from the east? This is Jesus Christ coming from the east. And he calls in righteousness to his feet. He delivers up nations before him and subdues kings. And he makes them like dust with his sword. And the wind-driven chaff with his bow, he pursues them, passing in safety and by a way that he had not been traversing with his feet. Meaning what? That verse 3. What does that mean? In other words, he's not coming back walking. He's coming back in the air. He's not traversing it with his feet. But where is he going to set down?
He's staying on the Mount of Olives.
The Mount of Olives. Very good.
But he comes through these gates in the Mount of Olives?
Or? No. He comes down and his feet will touch down on the Mount of Olives. Then there's a fault there that leads from the Mount of Olives underneath the east gate, which has been sealed up for centuries. And it's going to split wide open. He's going to walk from the Mount of Olives right into Jerusalem. He's going to slay the Antichrist and the false prophet with the breath of his mouth. Then he's going to raise them up. They're going to be the first fruits of the resurrection of the Lamb and thrown alive into the lake of fire. And then he's going to send forth all of his angels to go throughout all the world to gather up all the survivors of this 7-year Holocaust. And then he's going to divide them down there in Jerusalem when he sets up his glorious throne. And he's going to divide the sheep and the goats, saying, hey, man, I was hungry, I was thirsty, I was sick, I was naked in the prison, a stranger, and what did you do for me? And then the goats, he's going to slay with the breath of his mouth. Their souls are going to hell, and they're going to wait the great white throne judgment. And then those on his right, the sheep on his right, are going to go into his millennial kingdom after he recreates the world. Because Zephaniah said this about that day. He said this in Zephaniah chapter 1, near is the great day of the Lord, and near and coming very quickly. Listen, the day of the Lord. In it, the warrior cries out bitterly. A day of wrath is that day, a day of trouble and distress, a day of destruction and desolation, a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and thick darkness, a day of trumpet and battle cry against the fortified cities and the high corner towers. And I will bring distress on men so that they will walk like the blind. Why are they going to walk like the blind? Who's thinking?
They can't see.
They can't see? Why?
The sun's
gone out. So he says, I will bring distress on men so that they will walk like the blind because they have sinned against the Lord. And their blood will be poured out like dust and their flesh like dung. Where's that going to be? The wine press. What's the wine press?
Armageddon.
I'll read it again. And their blood will be poured out like dust and their flesh like dung. Neither their silver nor their gold will be able to deliver them on a day of the Lord's wrath. Now, what are they going to do with their silver and their gold? I just read it in Isaiah chapter 2. When they see Christ coming and they go into their caves and their caverns and the cliffs and the rocks and everything else, they're trying to hide from Christ. They're going to throw their silver and their gold to the bats and to the moles.
Okay.
To the moles. The moles, you know, I mean, the little rats that dig into the earth. Yeah, when they see Christ, and because they're going to throw the silver and gold to the brats and to the moles, because they recognize, you know what, this is going to be a conviction against me. Because what did James say that the rich are going to do? They're going to weep and they're going to wail over their riches, and it's going to burn them like fire, because it's going to be a testimony against them. Because when Jesus Christ separates the sheep from the goats, he's going to do it on the basis of what? I just said. I was hungry, I was thirsty, I was sick, I was naked, I was in prison, and what did you do for me? And these guys, with all the gold and silver, they didn't spend one dime to help anybody out.
No.
They hoarded it. They're misers. So, hey, this is a judgment coming against them. And so it says, neither their silver nor their gold will be able to deliver them on a day of the Lord's wrath, and all the earth will be devoured in the fire of his jealousy. I'm going to read this again, and you tell me from what. It says this, and all the earth will be devoured in the fire of his jealousy, for he will make a complete end, and indeed a terrifying one of all the inhabitants of the earth. That's pretty powerful, isn't it? It is to me, anyway. You know, and Isaiah, we read this earlier, when it talked about in Isaiah 13, where it talked about the end of the world, it talked about the second coming of Christ, it talked about what God is going to do when he returns. He says this, Wail, for the day of the Lord is near, and it will come as a destruction from the Almighty. Therefore all hands will fall limp, and every man's heart will melt, and they will be terrified. Pains and anguish will take hold of them, and they will ride like a woman in labor, and they will look at one another in astonishment, their faces aflame. Why are their faces aflame? Nuclear destruction. It says they will be terrified. Pains and anguish will take hold of them. They will ride like a woman in labor, and they will look at one another in astonishment, their faces aflame. Behold, the day of the Lord is coming, cruel with fury and burning anger, to make the land a desolation, and he will exterminate its sinners from it. Now, we're all sinners, so when it says he will exterminate its sinners from it, who's he talking about?
Those that haven't been saved.
Unrepentant sinners. He's going to exterminate them. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not flash forth their light, and the sun will be dark when it rises, and the moon will not shed its light. And didn't we just read that in Revelations? Become as black as sackcloth. And this is what it says in Isaiah 13. And he says, thus I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity, and also put an end to the arrogance of the proud and abase the haughtiness of the ruthless. Now listen to this. I will make mortal man scarcer than pure gold, and mankind than the gold of Ophir. Therefore I will make the heavens tremble, and the earth will be shaken from its place at the fury of the Lord of hosts in the day of his burning anger. I mean, that's pretty heavy, isn't it? And believe me, I know people think I'm just the biggest pessimist on the planet, but I have to emphasize this over and over again. I don't hopscotch through this Bible, and I do not skip anything. I read every chapter. I read every book. I read every verse. I read every word. I skip nothing. And I just go through it methodically. And yet you will be absolutely amazed, I certainly am, at the number of times it talks about destruction and judgment and the second coming of Christ and the carnage and the end of the world and how God is going to judge men. But we do not hear this from the pulpits today, do we? We just don't. Right? And I don't go out of my way to try to find this stuff. And you know that. I just go through one chapter at a time. But it truly is amazes me the number of times we read this type of thing. And then he says in verse 3, he pursues him, passing on in safety by a way he had not been traversing with his feet. Verse 4, who has performed it and accomplished it, calling forth the generations from the beginning. What does that mean? That verse 4. Who has performed it and accomplished it, calling forth the generations from the beginning?
Jesus is the one.
It's the Word.
Good. I think you got it. Here, close to it. Put it this way. Who has performed it and accomplished it, calling forth from the... In other words, who's predicted this from generations past? Who's predicted it? It's been him. Because read the whole verse now. Who has performed it and accomplished this, calling forth the generations from the beginning? I, the Lord... And the first, and with the last, I am He. All this stuff I'm sharing with you, it's God who has predicted this. From generation to generation, He has predicted it. All right? That's what I'm driving at. And yes, you read in Revelation, as a matter of fact, you read in Revelation chapter 1, Jesus Christ said in chapter 1, I am the Alpha and the Omega, who is and who was, and who is to come. And he also, in Revelation chapter 21, he says that he is the first and the last, the Alpha and the Omega. It says also in Isaiah 43, if I'm not mistaken, Jesus Christ said, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the A to Z, the beginning to the end. Or in other words, he's called it forth from all eternity, everything that's going to happen. You see, understand something. God just doesn't get up in the morning and say, man, I'm in a bad mood, I'm going to knock some heads together. No, he's predicted a time and a place, and all this is going to happen. It's from long ago, from the foundations of the earth. This has all been predicted. That's what he's talking about here. And at verse 5, he says, the coastlands have seen and are afraid. The ends of the earth tremble. They have drawn near and have come. Each one helps his neighbor and says to his brother, be strong. So now, talking about a second coming, they see all these things begin to happen. You know, they try to strengthen one another. As a matter of fact, in the book of Joel, he predicts that one of the ways that people are going to get down there to Armageddon is because the weak are going to say they're strong, and they're going to go down there with a determination that they're going to just kill each other and be victorious. Well, this is what it's talking about. Now, but read this beginning with verse 6. Each one helps his neighbor and says to his brother, be strong. So the craftsman encourages the smelter. Begin with verse 7. So the craftsman encourages the smelter, and he who smooths metal with the hammer encourages him who beats the anvil, saying of the soldering. It is good. And he fastens it with nails so that it will not totter. But you, Israel, my servant Jacob, whom I have chosen, descendant of Abraham, my friend, you whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and called from its remotest parts and said to you, you are my servant. I have chosen you and not rejected you. Do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be anxious. Look up. Verse 10 says, do not fear, for I am with you. Okay. Do not anxiously look about you, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Surely I will help you. Surely I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. Behold, all those who are angered at you will be shamed and dishonored, and those who contend with you will be as nothing and will perish. And you will seek those who quarrel with you, but you will not find them, and those who war with you will be nothing and non-existent. For I am the Lord your God, who upholds your right hand, who says to you, do not fear, I will help you. Do not fear, you worm Jacob, you men of Israel, I will help you, declares the Lord, and your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel. Now, before we go any further, I really probably should read it to the end, but I want to just back up a little bit, because he's making a stark contrast between these people who have put their faith in anything or everything other than Jesus Christ and the ones who put their faith and their trust in Jesus Christ. Because when you read this, and at verse 5, the coastlands have seen and are afraid. The ends of the earth tremble, and they have drawn near and have come. This is towards the end of the world. But then he interjects this. Each one of them helps his neighbor and says to his brother, be strong, so the craftsman encourages the smelter. And he who smooths metal with the hammer encourages him who beats the anvil, saying to the soldering, it is good. And he fastens it with nails so that it will not totter. Now, in that verse 7, he's talked about how men go to great lengths to fashion their own gods. But Israel has a God who's the real God. But here's the thing. I think it's very easy for people to read that verse 7 and go right over their head. But you tell me how this can really apply to today and what's happening all around us today. That verse 7. So the craftsman encourages the smelter, and he who smooths the metal with a hammer encourages him who beats the anvil, saying of the soldering, it is good, and he fastens it with nails so that it will not totter. Now, he's obviously talking about those who make graven images, those who fashion idols, right? But now you tell me, how does this apply to us today? Because it's happening all over our world, and it's happening all over this country.
Wall Street.
Well, put it this way, all right? There are some sacred cows in this country today that have been elevated to the point of idols, that have really superseded the things that God has said. And I'll give you an example. Apply it to evolution, okay? It absolutely amazes me how, quote-unquote, science will bend over backwards and it completely will make all these mental leaps to try to say, you know what, we all just came from apes. It really, really, really angers me. It really is. It's almost like, are these people really serious? Are these people really, really serious? They will take a fragment of a bone no bigger than my fingernail and build up this so-called half-ape, half-man, and they will mold it all up, right? Now, this is an idol. It really is. It really is. But if you don't bow down to this thing and say, well, yeah, well, I believe in evolution. I still believe in God, but I believe in evolution. Well, you know what? You're bowing down to this idol. People really are. Now, I don't want to get off my tangent. You want to believe in evolution, you can still be saved and believe in that stupidity. But I'm telling you what, you go down that road and you go down long enough, eventually you're not going to be saved because of where that leads. All right, it's an idol. You cannot touch it. You are referred to as ignorant and stupid and naive, and you know that always that science speaks and science proves. It does not. Science does not prove this one bit. It doesn't prove it at all. Matter of fact, every time they come up with a quote-unquote new finding, it contradicts their old finding. And my point is this. When you read this, apply it to evolution. When it says, saying of the soldering, it is good, and he fastens it with nails so that it will not totter. They've got to do everything to hold this thing up. And they are exalting it above God and his word and what he has said. And that's an idol. Same thing with abortion. Look at what's happened there. These people will not admit what abortion is. Abortion, it's genocide. Abortion is child killing. It's the murder of innocent human beings. It's extermination, it's slaughter, it's executing babies. But how do the abortionists define it?
Choice.
It's a choice. It's a fetus. It's a blob of protoplasm. It's only between the woman and her doctor, the woman and her God. I mean, all these phrases go on and on and on and on. They are really bent over backwards to try to hold up this idol and prop it up. But the truth is, look, this is murder. And I really do believe that the church today really needs, they really need people who can show some guts when it comes up to standing up against these sacred cows. Because the church today, especially men in the church, I mean, in my opinion, they've been disemboweled, they've been emasculated. To put it bluntly, I think that the church, especially men in the church, really need to grow a pair and stand up for what is right, for what God has said, and proclaim the truth. But, of course, when you do that, you're just going to be hated, you're going to be vilified, you're going to be lambasted to no end. But I'm telling you, this is the difference between these people who prop up their sacred cows and bow down and worship their rear end and demand that everybody else do it, comparison to the real God of the Bible. Because you read this verse 8, "But you, Israel, my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, descendant of Abraham, my friend, you whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and called from the remotest parts and said to you, you are my servant, I have chosen you and not rejected you. Do not fear, for I am with you." You know, that's what it takes. It really does. To stand up against this kind of stupidity, I don't care whether it's evolution or abortion or homosexuality. I mean, you're going to be vilified, you're going to be hated, you're going to be lambasted, you're going to be attacked one way, shape, or form or another. So when it says here, "Do not fear, I am with you. Do not anxiously look about you, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Surely I will help you. Surely I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. Behold, all those who are angry at you will be shamed and dishonored. Those who contend with you will be as nothing and will perish." Right now, I mean, it really looks bad for people who take a stand for God, because they're just vilified to no end by the media, by the cultural elite, just from every corner. But I really believe that, I look at it this way, it's almost like sometimes I just feel like I'm just in a foxhole and you're all alone and, you know, so many people on retreat. Well, this battle may be lost, but I know this, the war is going to be won. That's why we need to stand fast. And when we stand fast for Christ and for uphold His word and stand up for righteousness, this is what it says in that verse 11 of 41 of Isaiah. It says, "Behold, all those who are angry at you will be shamed and dishonored. Those who contend with you will be as nothing and will perish. And you will seek those who quarrel with you, but you will not find them. And those who war with you will be as nothing and non-existent." Why? Because you're on the right side of eternity and you're on the right side of heaven. And then he says in verse 13, "For I am the Lord your God who upholds your right hand, who say to you, do not fear, I will help you. Do not fear, you worm Jacob, you men of Israel, I will help you, declares the Lord. Your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel." Now, interesting thing. God says, "You worm Jacob." What does that tell you? What does that suggest to you? What does that say to you?
Well, he's nothing.
Well, yeah, you know what? I mean, even in the book of Job, I mean, it was Bildad who said something I thought was pretty interesting. I mean, having been through the Marine Corps, I thought that this guy must have been the first Marine, because in the book of Job, he says, "How then can man be just with God, or how can he be clean who is born of woman? Even if the moon has no brightness and the stars are not pure in his sight, how much less that maggot, the son of man, that worm?" You know, and you know what? I don't want to bore you to death. I probably already am. Half you people look like you're sleeping on me. But I've been writing this book, this is just a small chapter. It's titled 101 Insights for the Soul, and this is one of the insights. But when I'm reading about here where God is calling Jacob a worm, this is the title of it, "The Training of Maggots and the Disciplining of Worms." It starts off, it says, "Semper Fi." This is a Latin phrase known throughout the world by Marines and ex-Marines alike. It simply means always faithful. It denotes a bond and a fellowship between brothers and sisters who have gone through a common experience in both their training and their ordeals. Their harsh discipline and tough level of instruction has powerfully taught them to always remain faithful to their country and to each other and to their corps. I personally went through the Marine Corps during the height of the Vietnam War in the late 1960s. Our training was very intense and at times very even brutal. The Marine Corps had a unique way of taking young men from all over the country and from all walks of life and breaking down physically, mentally, and emotionally before they would build them up into lean, mean fighting machines, quote-unquote, that they were looking for, the Marine Corps was looking for. Two of the often used phrases by drill instructors when yelling at new recruits were "you maggot" or "you worm." Of course, they used many other terms of endearment that shouldn't be repeated here for the sake of decency and discreetness. However, you get the picture. The voice, the language, and the countenance of the DI was meant to strike fear into the hearts of cocksure adolescents and fashion them into disciplined men. Well, it wasn't until I returned home from Vietnam that I became a Christian, and it was then that I began to read the Bible. It was then I discovered a man who I thought for sure must have been the first Marine Corps drill instructor. His name was Bildad, and he was one of Job's three friends, and who began to attack Job's integrity and his truthfulness. He said, "How then can a man be just with God, or how can he be clean who is born of woman? Even the moon has no brightness, and the stars are not pure in his sight. How much less man, that maggot, and the son of man, that worm?" Well, Bildad was certainly in Job's face as he tried to break him down with his harsh language and as he insultingly implied that Job was nothing more than a maggot and little more than a worm. But in the end, it was Job who proved to be the stronger and the better man in the eyes of God. However, God's painful experiences were God's difficult training ground and the Lord's challenging boot camp. God is still in the business today of looking for a few good men who can endure his painful drills and who can undergo his trying instructions. His school of discipline can often be exhausting, sometimes brutal. He knows how to break his new recruits and to purge them of their arrogance and their self-indulgent urges. He knows how to push a man and to press a woman until they surrender completely to his ways and until they are marching to the drumbeat of his perfect will. As the writer of Hebrews put it, quote, "You have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood in your striving against sin. And have you forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as sons? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you are reproved by him. For those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines, and he scourges every son whom he receives. It is for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as sons. For what son is there that his father does not discipline? But if you are without discipline, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Furthermore, we have had earthly fathers to discipline us, and we respected them. Shall we not much rather be subjected to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time, as seemed best to them. But he disciplines us for our good, so that we may share in his holiness. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. Yet those who have been trained by it, afterwards it yields a peaceable fruit of righteousness. Therefore strengthen the hands that are weak and the knees that are feeble, and make straight the path of your feet, so that the limb which is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed." That's in Hebrews chapter 12, and it says even Jesus Christ himself had to undergo the humiliation of discipline and feeling like a worm. The psalmist said of him, "I am a worm and not a man, a reproach of men, despised by people." And in the training of Israel, God said, "Do not fear, you worm Jacob, you men of Israel. I will help you, declares the Lord, and your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel. Behold, I have made you a new sharp threshing sledge and double edges. With double edges, you will thresh the mountains and pulverize them, and you will make the hills chaff, and you will winnow them, and the wind will carry them away, and the storm will scatter them, and you will rejoice in the Lord, and you will glory in the Holy One of Israel." That's Isaiah 41. We are just reading here. God's disciplines prepare us for war, and once we are equipped with his spiritual armor, Ephesians 6, we are sure to gain the victory in whatever battles that he sends us into, if only we remain always faithful, quote unquote. So the next time God's training school makes you feel like you have been reduced to little more than a maggot and have been diminished to little more than a worm, remember, it is because he is still in the business of looking for a few good men and women. Now, I just shared that one chapter with you because it goes hand in glove with what are we reading here. When God calls Jacob a worm, and God is saying, you know what, even though you're lowly, even though you're without strength, I'm going to be there. I'm going to be your God. I'm going to be your strength. And all these people who contend with you, all these people that are in your face, all these people who are at war with you because of your stand for me and because of the stand of righteousness, they're going to be put to shame. That's what he's saying. And then at verse 15, "Behold, I have made you a new sharp threshing sledge with double edges. You will thresh the mountains and pulverize them and will make the hills like chaff." Now, when is that going to be? At the end of the world. God's going to bring down the whole world, man. He's going to use the Jews to do it. He's going to judge the world through the Jews. Verse 16, "You will winnow them, and the wind will carry them away, and the storm will scatter them. But you will rejoice in the Lord, and you will glory in the Holy One of Israel." Who is the Holy One of Israel?
Jesus
Christ. Jesus Christ is the Holy One of Israel. And he's talking about here, he's talking about his people, but he's primarily talking about the Jews. And what are the Jews going to do when they see Jesus Christ coming back? Anybody remember? Anybody know?
They're going to say, is it Jeremiah?
Okay. Good. It says in Zechariah chapter 12, it says this: in that day the Lord will defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and the one who is feeble among them in that day will be like David, and the house of David will be like God, like the angel of the Lord before them. And in that day I will set about to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. And he says this: I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplication, so that they will look on me whom they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only son, and they will weep bitterly over him like the bitter weeping over a firstborn. And that day there will be a great mourning in Jerusalem. So when they see Jesus Christ coming, great power, great glory, he's coming from the east, but believe it or not, he's coming up over Bozrah, and you can't see it on this map here. So it appears to me he goes to Mount Sinai first from the east, then he heads north, because he comes from the south when he comes up to Jerusalem. So what does it suggest to you if he were to go to Mount Sinai first?
Where the Ten Commandments
yes.
are or something?
Yes. Like now, expand upon that. Why would he do that?
Because Moses was good. Hidden and
good.
Got the law.
So here's the thing. All these people that are going to be judged by him have rejected his grace. Now he's coming from the law. And the law can't save you. Now they're going to be judged by the law. You see? That's why he's coming that way. But when he goes over Bozrah, and when he goes over Edom, and over Petra, and over coming from basically the south, going up north towards Jerusalem, every eye is going to see him. And when the Jews see him, they're going to weep upon him whom they have pierced.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to weep convulsively as the weeping over a firstborn. Now, what does that mean?
Well, it means they can't. Or to be consoled, I don't know.
Well, define it. In other words, he says, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only son, and they will weep bitterly over him like the bitter weeping over a firstborn. Put it where we live and breathe. Imagine you and your son. Maybe he's 12, 13 years old, maybe younger, whatever. You go out on a hunting trip together. All right? And then you accidentally mistake him for a deer in a thicket, and you shoot him dead. Now, what is going to be your response?
Guilt. Weeping and crying.
You're going to be overwhelmed, aren't you?
Oh, yeah.
You're going to be overwhelmed with a sense of grief and remorse and just beating yourself up. Now, when the Jews see Jesus Christ coming back, they're going to be overwhelmed saying, how could we have mistaken the Son of God for a blasphemer? Just like a guy would say, how could I have mistaken my son for a deer? That's how it's going to tear him up. There's going to be no crocodile tears.
Yeah.
None at all. These people are going to really be grief-stricken. All right? But God's going to have pour out a spirit of supplication upon them where they turn to him in sorrow and grief, and he's going to save them. All right? It's going to be a remnant of them.
Now, is this going to be after Armageddon?
Put it this way. It's during Armageddon. During Armageddon. This whole thing takes place at the very last moments of the world.
Oh, okay.
When he comes back. It's just before he slays the armies of Armageddon. Okay. When they see him going overhead, great power, great glory, they're going to say, this is Jesus Christ. They're going to look upon him whom they have pierced. All right? They're going to weep bitterly over him. But God's going to be merciful to them. And then it says here in verse 17, Isaiah chapter 41, it says, the afflicted and the needy are seeking water, but there is none, and the tongue is parched with thirst. I, the Lord, I will answer them myself. As the God of Israel, I will not forsake them. Now, apply that spiritually. When it says the afflicted and the needy are seeking water, what did Jesus Christ say about water?
He is the living water.
I said, I am the living water. Whoever comes to me will never thirst again, right?
Right.
And so when people are thirsting, they're thirsting for answers, they're thirsting for the truth. But everywhere men look, if they are not looking to Jesus Christ, it's not going to satisfy. It is not going to fulfill them at all. So that's what it's talking about here, especially he's talking to the Jews. The afflicted and needy are seeking water, but there is none. And their tongue is parched with thirst. I, the Lord, will answer them myself. Right?
Yeah.
As the God of Israel, I will not forsake them. Verse 18, I will open the rivers on the bare heights and the springs in the midst of the valley, and I will make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land fountains of water. Now, when's he going to do that? When he comes back, the world's in a total ecological disaster. All the oceans have been turned to blood. Every living creature and organism in the sea is going to be dead. Imagine the stench of that. All the fresh water is going to be turned to blood. A third of all the trees of the earth are going to be burned up, and all the green grass is going to be burned up. I mean, the carnage is going to be unbelievable. And not only that, the earthquake is going to bring everything down, and there's going to be 100-pound hailstones just pulverizing the earth and men on earth. Now, how are we going to get 100-pound hailstones?
Through the nuclear atmosphere.
Good.
The nuclear
good.
War.
I don't know if you guys read. I was reading in, I think it was the USA Today 3 weeks ago. There was an article there that they found, I think it was a 40-pound hailstone.
Oh.
It may have been 25, but it was just enormous. But John says there's going to be 100-pound hailstones hitting the earth. And I just put it together. If our sun has gone out, and I believe it's going to be for 3 days, and then you're going to see an all-out nuclear exchange, well, our atmosphere is basically going to be frozen up there. And when you got this nuclear explosion that pushes out all this hot air and all this debris, and it comes back together, and it just collides, and it forms this mushroom cloud, and you got all this heat, you know, thousands of degrees, just shooting up into the atmosphere and colliding with all that frozen cold air, it's going to form tremendous sheets of ice. They're going to come down and pulverize the earth, and it's going to be a deluge of just rain and ice and sleet and snow coming down from this nuclear destruction. That's what he's talking about here. So the earth is going to be utterly destroyed, but that verse 18 is when Christ recreates everything. Because in Zephaniah it says that the earth is going to be so destroyed that, you know what Jesus Christ is going to have to do when he returns? What's that? It says here in Zephaniah, I will completely remove all things from the face of the earth, declares the Lord. I will remove man and beast. I will remove the birds of the sky and the fish of the sea and the ruins along with the wicked. And I will cut off man from the face of the earth, declares the Lord. In other words, Christ is going to have to remove things and recreate the world so it can be inhabited again, because nobody could survive in this ecological disaster that man has created. Oh. So that's what he's talking about. That verse 19 is Isaiah chapter 41. It says, and I will put the cedar in the wilderness and the acacia and the myrtle and the olive tree, and I will place the juniper in the desert together with the box tree and the cypress, meaning he's going to recreate everything. Now there's verse 20, that they may see and recognize and consider and gain insight as well that the hand of the Lord has done this and the Holy One of Israel has created it. And I'll just share something with you. You know all the rough edges I have, okay? You guys think I got rough edges now. I was really, really had some rough edges as a new Christian. Long story short, as some of you know, I began writing books as a new Christian, and of course nothing was published. Long story short, I was in a restaurant one day, and I was going over one of my manuscripts, and I just thought, this is terrible, and I just started crumpling up page after page after page and through page and so on to the side, and I just thought, oh, this is terrible. And then, you know, I just said to myself, man, it's no wonder people are ashamed of me. And then I said to myself, man, even God must be ashamed of me. This is terrible. And God's never spoken to me audibly or verbally, you know, before, but I really felt like he spoke to me very, very clearly in my heart. And it just came from nowhere, this thought. It said, John, if you had a four-year-old son and he really, really worked hard on the finger painting at school for you and he brought it home to you and gave it to you, would you be ashamed of that?
Yes, no.
That's what just hit me like a ton of bricks. You know? And it was so God was saying, look, it's true, you got a lot of rough edges and you really got a lot of, you know, growing up to do, but I'm not ashamed of you. I'm proud of you. I'm proud of your zeal. And just stay with it. Now, that really wasn't the story I was going to share. I forgot. I mean, I just happened to get off on a tangent there, but the story I wanted to share was about this verse 20, and it had to do with my book, because in that verse 20 it says, that they may see and recognize and consider and gain insight as well that the hand of the Lord has done this and the Holy One of Israel has created it. And this is what I'll share with you. When I finished writing my first book, it was titled Live for Christ Today Because Nobody Promised You Tomorrow. And I wrote it all out, printed it out, and I paid a retired English teacher to type it up for me. And anyway, the day it was finished, I went out to a lonely place to just pray about my book, because I really felt kind of excited about it. And I really, really wanted God to speak to me. I really was just almost praying, oh, Lord, speak to me about this book. Now, understand something. I hardly ever, ever, I can only remember doing this one time, and I don't encourage anybody to do it, but I just opened my Bible, flipped it open, and I wanted God to speak to me, and I said, God, speak to me. And I just flipped open my Bible randomly, and my finger went right to this Isaiah chapter 41, verse 20. And I thought God was saying this about my book. And I'll read it again. That they may see and recognize and consider and gain insight as well, that the hand of the Lord has done this and the Holy One of Israel has created it.
No.
Now that really spoke to me in my heart. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now all of you guys know that all my books have ended up in a trash can. But I'm in the process of writing another book. And who knows? Maybe someday this verse may really come true. Maybe this was God really speaking to me, because I really felt like he spoke to me through this verse.
Yeah.
I really did about my book. Now, I could be dead wrong, and I'm not trying to be melodramatic, but that's what that verse spoke to me about that. Let's just wind this down. Verse 29, present your case, the Lord says. Bring forward your strong arguments, the King Jacob says. Let them bring forth and declare to us what is going to take place. As for the former events, declare what they were, that they may consider them and know their outcome, or announce to us what is coming. Declare the things that are going to come afterwards, that we may know that you are gods indeed. Do good or evil, that we may anxiously look about us and fear together. Now, what he's saying here, what we've been reading this chapter 41, and of course, firstly, all of Isaiah and so much of the Bible, it's primal prophecy about the second coming of Jesus Christ. And when he says this, and that's verse 21, 22, and 23, you tell me what he's saying. He says, present your case to the Lord, he says. Bring forth your strong arguments, the King of Jacob says. Let them bring forth and declare to us what is going to take place, as the former events declare what they were, that we may consider them and know their outcome, or announce to us what is coming. Declare the things that are going to come afterwards, that we may know that you are gods indeed. Do good or evil, that we may anxiously look about us and fear together. What does that mean? In other words, God's throwing a challenge out there, and he's throwing it out to all the false prophets, saying, okay, if you know so much, then declare the things that are going to happen, just like Isaiah did. You guys have all heard of Nostradamus, right? Right. He lived back in the 15th century. He was a French, he was actually a Jew who his family converted to Christianity, and obviously what he was into, it was basically sorcery. But you know how he used to write out his quatrains? His quatrains were nothing but verses or prophecies about things that are going to happen in the future. He'd look into a pail of water or a plate of water or a bowl of water, just like somebody would look into a crystal ball, and then he'd come up with these quatrains. Well, if you ever read his quatrains, they are so vague and they're so ambiguous, you have to really make all kinds of mental leaps and mental just gymnastics to get it to fit anything. Like if you say, well, this applies to the Twin Towers, or well, this applies to World War II, or this applies to Hitler. That guy was not of God. I don't care what anybody says. Nostradamus was not a prophet of God. All right? He was a charlatan, and his powers came from the powers of darkness. And his prophecies are a joke. You can't figure them out. But that's not so when you're reading Isaiah, is it? It's really not. So that's what that challenge is about. And winding this down, verse 24, behold, you are of no account, and your work amounts to nothing. He who chooses you is an abomination. Apply that to Nostradamus. Apply that to all the horoscopes. Apply that to all the psychics. And apply that to all the fortune tellers we got going today. I used to run track with a high guy in high school, and one day I was studying my Bible in the library, and he came in, and I hadn't seen him for years, and we just started talking, and just asked him what he's up to, and he says, well, I create horoscopes for people. Professionally, he charts people's stars for them. And I try to tell him he's barking up the wrong tree, or, of course, couldn't get to first base with him, but there's a lot of people that he won't get out of bed without reading the horoscopes. I mean, this is the big difference when it says in that verse 24, behold, you are of no account, and your work amounts to nothing. He who chooses you is an abomination. Verse 25, I have aroused one from the north, and he has come. And from the rising of the sun, he will call on my name, and he will come upon rulers as upon mortar, even as the potter treads clay. Who has declared this from the beginning that we might know, or from former times that we might say, he is right, Surely there is no one who declares. Surely there is no one who proclaims. Surely there is no one who heard your words. Formerly I said to Zion, behold, here they are, and to Jerusalem I will give a messenger of good news. But when I looked, there was no one, and there is no counselor among them who, if I ask, can give an answer. Behold, all of them are false. Their works are worthless. Their molten images are wind and emptiness. Now, just winding this down, you see the big difference? You see the stark difference between a true prophet of God and a false prophet of God? That's what God is saying here.
Yeah.
He's made predictions centuries, thousands of years into the future. And we have seen so many of them fulfilled in minute detail. And we were on the very threshold of seeing all the rest of them fulfilled, you know, probably in our lifetime. That's the real difference between these charlatans. That's what God is making the contrast here. Now, verse 25, I have roused one from the north, and he has come. From the rising of the sun, he will call on my name, and he will come upon the rulers as upon mortar, even as the potter treads clay. Who's he talking about? Look at it. Break it down. Analyze it. It's, well, look at it. I have aroused one from the north, and he has come from the rising of the sun, and we'll call him by name. It's Jesus Christ. He will come upon the rulers as upon mortar. He's just going to, you know, come upon all the world leaders and rulers and crush them, even as the potter treads the clay. He says, who has declared this from the beginning that we might know, or from former times that we might say he is right? That's the contrast he's trying to make here between what the Bible says, what God has spoken through his word, and all these charlatans, okay, all these horoscopes, all these zodiacs, all these false prophets, all these fortune tellers, all these diviners. He says, surely no one who declared, surely there was no one who proclaimed, surely there was no one who heard your words. Formerly I said to Zion. Now who's Zion? God's people is Jerusalem, okay, the Jews.
Yeah,
behold, here they are, and to Jerusalem I will give a message of good news. This is the good news. We're almost done there, hanging there. I know half you guys are asleep on me. Verse 28, but when I looked, there was no one, and there is no counselor among them who, if I ask, can give an answer. In other words, you know, even today, just look around, and who's got the answer? I don't claim to have the answer, but I certainly can read, and I can see who has the answer is God. And you look around, and who's looking to God today? Right? Who's looking to his word?
Mm-hmm.
It's not happening. Everybody's being misled. But you tell me, why do people ignore what God has clearly said and have proven himself over and over and over and over again that this is the word of God? Why do people ignore this and go listen to something else?
Because they want to hear what they want to hear.
Good, good. Because this is what it says in Timothy. This is what it's going to be like in the last days. It says in 2 Timothy chapter 4, Paul says, I solemnly charge you in the presence of God in Christ Jesus, who is the judge of the living and the dead, and by his appearing and his coming, to preach the word. This is what we're doing right now. To preach the word. To be ready in season and out of season, to reprove, rebuke, exhort with great patience and instruction, for the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but wanting to have their ears tickled, they will accumulate for themselves teachers and according to their own desires, and turn away their ears from the truth and turn aside to myths. That's what's happening.
That's what's happening today.
That's what I'm saying. That's what's happening today. That's why there's making this contrast between a true prophet of God, what he has predicted centuries and thousands of years into the future, and we can see it unfolding right before our eyes.
Yeah.
Okay, and all these other charlatans all around us. Right? That's what he's talking about. For that last verse 29, chapter 41 of Isaiah, behold, all of them are false. Their works are worthless. Their molten images are wind and emptiness. And we're surrounded by them. We really are. Everything that excludes Jesus Christ or perverts what he has said in his word is full of futility and emptiness. Anybody have anyone to add or share?
The book of Isaiah, child, is that basically related to the last days? Is the predominantly most of the book of Isaiah?
Well, put it this way. He pronounces judgments upon Israel, upon all these various nations, but he talked a lot about the first coming of Christ. As a matter of fact, he predicted Christ's virgin birth. He predicted in chapter 9 of Isaiah that a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest upon his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. This is what Isaiah predicted, right?
And how he would be crucified.
Yeah, and he predicted Isaiah 53. He predicted Christ's crucifixion. He predicted his burial. He predicted his resurrection. So it's not just the end of the world that he talked about, but he talked about the first coming of Christ, the second coming of Christ, okay. The judgment that God would bring upon all these different nations, including his own people, and then, of course, the world. I mean, the guy is an amazing prophet. He truly is an amazing prophet. Okay. It's amazing, his predictions.
Yeah.
All right. And just in closing, about Isaiah, anybody remember how God called him?
He said, who do I have to send? Isaiah said, here I am, Lord, send me.
Yeah, but what happened to him?
It's in the first year of Uzziah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I know.
Oh, okay, well, it's chapter 6. Isaiah says, I saw the Lord high and lifted up and exalted, and his train filled the temple. And he said this, my first reaction was, woe is me, for I am undone, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell among a people of unclean lips. And he thought to himself, man, I got to get out of here. I'm just a sinful man in the presence of a holy God. But what happened to him right there?
The angel came with a vertical.
And touched his lips and cleansed him. And then when God says, man, who am I going to send? Then he says, here I am, Lord, send me. And tradition says that Isaiah was martyred. Anybody know how?
His body was cut in half.
Yeah, they put him inside a hollowed out log, and then they sawed the log in half with him in it. Now, you won't read that in the Bible, but that's Isaiah. The guy we're reading, that's why I'm trying. This guy.
How do you know it then?
Well, that's Jewish tradition.
Who?
Jewish tradition.